Hi, everyone. Welcome to Seattle HempFest 2019, the second panel of Saturday. I've received our sponsor call-out sheet. I'm going to make those. I'll say a little something, then we'll run down the row, and we'll try to get out of here by 12:10, so we have a nice transition moment for the next panel. We will also try to incorporate some questions from the audience for this one. Thank you so much to our sponsors. They help make this happen. It's very, very important. Genuinely grateful to all of those folks. Please also don't forget to throw a little money in the kitty for on your own at the various places where you can throw a dollar, $5, $20 in. And with that, we shall start our second panel. Growers, processors, and labs, from seed to your stash. This is a smorgasbord of topics, but actually from my home discipline of geography, we have a term for it, actually, that encapsulates all of it. It's called a commodity chain, right? A commodity chain from seed to your stash, and presumably your endocannabinoid system as well. So fairly broad topic, but I guess what my thoughts to the panel in terms of do a little introduction and spiel is to think about, if you'd like, your place in this commodity chain, right? As something that it's not just you, it's the whole chain that makes it work, right? And I'd like you to ask, kind of like, to reflect a little bit on that if you can. But we will start by going down the row with the esteemed Danny Danko from High Times Magazine. Thank you, Danny, for coming today.
Thank you for having me. Hello, Seattle. I'm Danny Danko. I'm senior cultivation editor of High Times Magazine. I guess my place in the chain is to really just, I want to encourage people to grow their own and feed lightly. Everything, you know, when you're getting into the concentration stage, you're concentrating everything. So, you know, you don't want to use things that are harmful. And so I would encourage people to grow their own and feed lightly and tread lightly as well. Use sunshine, take advantage of, you know, healthy soil, living soil, and that's it. So that's kind of, you know, the beginner. I wrote this book called Cannabis, Beginner's Guide to Growing Marijuana, and it's basically for people that are entry level and want to get started creating their own cannabis and even doing their own processing as well in a safe manner. So, and that's important as well.
Thank you, Danny. I think that's pretty awesome that this is a focus for you and for High Times, actually, to encourage people to learn how to establish that personal relationship with the plant and have the whole commodity chain be, like, you know, their own. That's part of our ecology as well, right? The home grow as well as the market. Okay, next up, Alex Cooley from Solstice.
Never did I think I'd sit on a High Times panel and discuss supply chain and supply chain management perspectives, but here we are. So in the supply chain or commodity chain, as you call it, particularly myself and my company, I manage supply chain from development of a cultivar to retail and essentially everything in between. So cultivar selection is a big part of where I spend my time these days, determining kind of our... I look at it as painting a picture with colors, and so building cultivars is building different colors and color spectrums and how that affects people and their endocannabinoid system, and really, really focusing on providing unique experiences with cannabis and then across all of our brands. So I'd say I really take up the first kind of two-thirds of the supply chain and really, really, really focused on value for our customers as well as ourselves. I also home grow still to this day for kind of for fun and experimentation and just really making sure that, you know, we're providing quality cannabis, whether that's to ourselves or to the many customers who choose to support us.
Thanks. And Alex, I'd point out that commodity chain encompasses like the consumption part of it as well. Supply chain would be up to
the consumer.
Exactly. Quick question, actually, now you bring it up. In terms of your cultivar curation, have you mostly been doing like pheno hunting from seed, or are you looking for the people with, is that hunt, you know, in-house? Is it the outhouse.
Yeah, I've kind of steered the company towards seed and phenotype selection, chemotype selection. I find at the end of the day, we end up with a better representation of that cultivar for us. We've spent plenty of time doing, you know, keeper cut deals or trading cuts and things of that nature. And even some of the best cannabis I've ever smoked in my life that may have come from a different place as a cutting to us, it just doesn't necessarily perform as well if we popped 100 seeds and found our cultivar and our phenotype. So I'm pushing us in that direction, though to the chagrin of our head of horticulture.
It's overhead.
Well, it's overhead. It's long. It takes a really, really, really long time to develop a cultivar to be offered at scale to the public. It should take 2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's really what it should take, but we're trying to condense it down into 9 months.
Yep.
So I'm making phenotype selection off one flower. So we'll run a seed set, and I will. What I make them do is, as soon as they can pull a cut, they pull a cut, put that cut in a library, and immediately flower out that seedling. And I'll make a call in a room before it's even done, basically on a kill list. Okay. I can choose who we kill about halfway through, but then I'll get. I mean, we'll maybe get a plant that's this big, that's been pruned to get this before. For me to make one or two phenotype selections, then it will go into what we call a trial commercial scale. So we'll run something like, I don't know, a bench, and a bench is like 12 lights. And then we'll determine, I try to have it to two phenos, like I said, we'll determine by that bench which pheno will win at a scalable scenario, because it has to grow well too, because you have to check a lot of boxes for a cultivar to make it to the kind of the full stage. And so they really don't like that. And so it's easier in theory of like, oh, we know that, you know, this purple punch is really good and so has it, and we can get cuts from them in the system. And so we'll get, you know, like I would never trust to just go plant a room of it. And it's just never the right one. You can always, 9 times out of 10, you can always do better if you do your own seed hunt and your own phenotype selection.
Interesting, interesting. Thank you. Gianna from Wham Oil.
Hi, yes. My name is Gianna from Wham Oil. Do cannabis oil manufacturing. So we grow to extract, and we put out a cartridge in the market. So from my perspective, I've been basically a patient for the last 38 years. So my whole life has been around dealing with my health, which is why I got into this business. So from my perspective, and what I like to do is basically make sure that the products that we are growing, that we are extracting, that we are outsourcing are clean, so that way we can extract clean and pure oil. So we make sure that all of our lots are tested, pesticide tested, and also educate the consumer about buying safe products and what it means and what they need to ask. The pesticide world is quite interesting, and it's
that's a good way to put it. It's
so complex, and the water that we drink, the air we breathe, and the food we eat is all contaminated. So
it's a chemical age.
Exactly. So my whole thing is like, how do we mitigate that within our facility? We have to do the best we can to make sure that we grow clean cannabis and that we're extracting clean product. So it's really doing the best we can with what we have to create those products. And that's really important to me, because if I'm not going to take it, why would I give it to you? So that's kind of where I come from.
That's awesome. That kind of brings us back to actually, you know, Danny's project of like, you know, teaching people how to grow their own. And I'm interested in your perspective, like, why is it harder, I guess, to do this at scale than it is perhaps at a micro level,
well,
with pesticides?
Well, one, micro level, we have control. If I'm growing a plant in my backyard, I know exactly what I'm doing to it, exactly. And, you know, you can buy good, solid products. And those products, those nutrients, are kind of expensive. So I think that a lot of the commercial growers, not all of them, but I think they think about their budget. all right? And so they'll go and they'll buy nutrients that have proprietary blends. So you may be looking at a nutrient or a pesticide and it may say that it's safe, but when you go to test that product at the end of the day after it's been extracted, an oil finished product, it fails. So when you're growing micro level, you have total control. When you're growing on a mass scale level, it's hard to control what employees are going to do. You have your own process and your own policies in-house, but a lot of the times you have employees that are out there, they want to do a good job, something happens, oh my God, I'm going to let off a bug bomb and not say anything, because it's happened. I know we've had growers that have told us that, oh wow, we had somebody that did that. So I think it's just a lot harder to control when you're dealing with a lot more people.
Thank you. Nick Mosley from Confidence Analytics on the testing side.
Yeah, so I work for a testing lab, and we're an independent testing lab. So our role in the commodity chain is to act as a third party to take samples and test them. We don't buy or sell cannabis. We act as an independent third party. Testing was required by Initiative 502, and I think, you know, the lab's role in the market, as intended by the initiative, was for safety, right? It's for public safety. It's so that we, especially on the pesticide front, you know, we are testing these products to make sure that they're safe to go to market. But I would propose that it's more than that. It's not just safety. It's also trust. Consumers they want trust in the products that they're buying, and when a new commodity chain comes to market, you know, there's a balloon of new brands, and it's often difficult for consumers, especially in the beginning, to understand what brands to trust and why. And testing provides one piece of the puzzle when it comes to deciphering the diverse product space, and for consumers to have a mechanism for identifying brands and products that are trustworthy. And I think, you know, it gets back to, you know, what Danny was saying about, you know, growing it at home. A big reason for why someone would want to do that is for the trust aspect, because they can have trust in themselves when perhaps it's difficult to identify brands and products to have trust in. So I think the answer to the question of, you know, what is the role of testing in the commodity chain? It's for safety and it's for trust.
Can home growers or medical growers get their product tested at your lab?
Yes, there are no rules that bar testing labs from accepting samples from consumers. I know that some labs do. They're just a little nervous about that. But at our lab, absolutely, we accept samples from the patient and medical community. Actually, we give 50% discounts to medical patients.
That's awesome. I want to note also that it has been proposed that some of our cups that we're having in Washington State maybe take a cue from the Emerald Cup and begin to have patient categories, in which case we would need you guys to be testing, patient products as well, and open up competitions a little bit so that maybe we can see what people are growing at home. And
that sounds awesome,
that.
Like a home grow competition.
More or less. You'd have to have your medical authorization to be able to submit. But yeah,
that's awesome. I like that.
You like that? All right, yeah. We're going to do that next year for sure. All right, and finally, StinkBud, who I know you've been focused on educating folks on how to grow for a very long time. So go ahead.
How's it going? Excuse me. I'm StinkBud. I've been a grower since 1977. I wrote a book called Harvest a Pound Every 3 Weeks, and I've been actually working with Danny Danko over here at High Times Magazine since 2008. Please be sure and check out the October edition. My latest article on cannabis photography is in here, and anybody that wants to smoke some of the flower in these, just come see me afterwards. We'll be glad to take care of that for you. I've been a breeder. You know, I actually started out breeding from the very beginning because we didn't even know about clones and stuff a long time ago. That was kind of like, you know, in the 80s we learned about that kind of stuff. And so we were kind of forced to, like, start learning about picking different strains. And you know, we didn't even know. Like, when I first started, I didn't even know that there was a difference between a male and a female plant. I mean, I had a, like, there was no books or magazines and stuff, and it just wasn't very much, very many resources available and stuff. And through all the years and stuff, I've really kind of been focused more on the home grower and people like growing in their backyard and their closets, that sort of thing, for medical reasons. And just for personal reasons and stuff, I've really been trying to focus on how maybe I'd be able to help people like veterans. I try to come up with a breed of strain that's really good for stress, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress, that sort of thing. So, you know, I call it Veterans Kush. And so there's like, my focus has been more not so much on the commercial side of things, even though I've worked on a commercial farm for a few years, and right now I work for a commercial processor and everything. I still like to keep things in perspective on my other side and what I do. And I think that the home growers are going to keep are going to be the people that keep certain strains and certain phenotypes and certain just genetics going that are not commercially viable. Like the questions I have to ask on the farm and stuff, there's a lot of things that we have to think about, like if it's pest resistant, is it a good producer, you know, like the test results. I hate to say it, but you know, we have a hard time getting rid of stuff. You know, if we can get over 30%, people like beg us for our product, we don't have to try to sell it. And it's like, from a commercial standpoint, that means we're going to choose a lot of the high THC strains just because they sell better. They're not necessarily the best medicinally, they're not necessarily even the best weed, but people, there's a lot of THC hunters out there. And even though I know that's the reality of the commercial thing, it kind of, I don't want to say it pisses me off, but it kind of pisses me off. Because
it pisses all of us off.
It's a fact of the world right now.
Oh,
you know, my God, there's so many strains that people are missing out on. And it's like the home growers are the only guys that are actually going to be able to grow this stuff, because, like, I know for a fact that some of my favorite strains are, like, test under 15%. People laugh at me if I were to show them the test results. And I'm like, dude, this is, like, 8.6% terpenes, though, you know? Do you know what that means? And they're like, but what's the THC? And I'm like, who cares? It's 8.6% terpenes, dude. You know, it's 5.4 just in myrcene alone. This is amazing stuff, and you'll get way higher. And we produce stuff like that's pure THC crystals. I work for processors, and it's just so pure and so clear. And you hit it, and you don't taste anything. You don't really feel the effects, and it's that THC high that's a real clean, happy kind of high, but you don't feel really stoned or anything. So it's like over time, we've learned that it's all about the terpenes and what different terpenes there are and everything. And so, like, for me, it's all about mixing the different strains together, trying to find that right terpene match. What kind of terpenes can I get? We're starting to look into, like, I got Durban Poison, which has THCV, and that's a really rare. I can't find it anywhere else, and there's only one other strain, I think a White Haze or something, I even seen it, and it's nowhere else, and THCV has some unique properties. So can I start putting that into my other strains? And for years and years, everybody bred all the CBD out of all the strains. And it's just like, there's some of my favorite strains, like Critical Cure and some of the ACDC and stuff, have CBD in them. And so I'm starting to slowly breed CBD back in and trying to see, like, what are the different ratios? Is it 1-to-1? Is it 2-to-1? And maybe it's just for every person it's going to be different. So I want to start having where all my strains have a little bit of CBD in them. It just takes me, like, I'm just so small. I can't do 1,000. So it doesn't take me, you know, months. It takes me years and years and years to be able to pheno hunt and find the runs and mix it and stuff. So that's why, like, 35 years later, I still don't have, you know, I'm not done. I don't think I'll ever will be done. But anyway, if you guys ever want to talk and stuff afterwards, come look me up. We'll be around hanging out and stuff. We got, if you're ever interested in sampling anything, just, I'm always here to help everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Stink Bud. Great. So now I want to ask a couple of questions and then throw it out to the audience. But the first one I want to start with is, for each of you, what would you like to see changed policy-wise for your corner of the commodity chain right now? Any policy that you could wave a magic wand and change off the top of your head, what would it be?
I guess for me it's easy. It's home grow. It just gives you that option to do it yourself. And if you don't do it yourself, then at least you get the education of understanding, you know, when you go into a dispensary, you know, rather than looking at just the highest THC level, you can know what the terpene levels are. That's what's great about the lab testing as well, beyond just knowing about pesticides and all of that. You know about everything else that's in there. And we're just scratching the surface of the combinations of the different cannabinoids and terpenoids and flavonoids and all of that, and how they affect different people differently, and how they can suppress appetite, how they can increase appetite, and all these amazing properties. So, but if there's one policy change I would like, even here in Washington, where it's, you know, legal, but home grow is not. And where I live in New York, we have medical, but home grow, no home grow. So that's, to me, really important. That's the issue that's closest to my heart, aside from things like, you know, getting the prisoners out of jail and expunging people's criminal records, which is important. And then the third thing I would say is social use, being able to get together. So to me, I'd have to, I guess, pick three things. So, and it's those three. It's
go get it, Danny.
First thing would be not even home grow. It would be releasing all nonviolent marijuana offenders from jail immediately, expunging criminal records for anyone that, you know, that's the first step right there, because we can't have people making millions of dollars out here in the legal market and be leaving behind those prisoners. That's just not conscionable.
Thank you, Danny, for saying that. Thank you also for giving us a shout out that we need home grow here in Washington State. I'm fascinated by what's going on in New York, because the holdup there seems to be actually that, like, hey, you actually want to be considering these things. And without them, you're not going to let it happen.
Yeah, they want to do it right, and they want the communities that have been most devastated by the war on drugs to actually benefit. So there's equity programs and things that they're trying to put into the system to ensure that it's not just you know, Wall Street types that make the money. And so that's important. So those three things, getting the prisoners out, home grow, and social use are that kind of the new frontier of, you know, really truly freeing this healing flower.
Great, thank you. Alex?
I'll go with three, two of them being yours, Danny, and I'll kind of categorize it of, you know, personal preferences, world preferences, and then business preferences. And business is more on the commodity chain of it. From a business perspective, I don't necessarily, it's not a huge right now thing for me for full federal legalization, but it would be an open market for the genetics. I think that's one of the most stifled things of all of these communities or territories of cannabis, is that we're not allowed to bring in genetics from other places, and they magically appear at times somehow.
All the time now.
It seems that way. Well, we rebreed it. That's what we do. We rebreed it in-house. Yeah, we take some silver colloidal. Yeah. You know how we do it. That's how we do it compliantly. I think that's huge. Not having that ability to share resources from even whatever New York's doing or whatever California's doing or whatever the Netherlands are doing or Spain's doing, to not be able to openly exchange those cultivars and really kind of stabilize the genetic pool, because we're getting really far out there in hybridization world, and to deal with real commodity scale cultivation, we're so far away from it. Like, it's impossible to think how corn thinks. Not to say we should, but, like, or how heirloom tomatoes are planted and cultivated. Like, getting a real F1 stable feminized hybrid that we could go out and plant 10,000 at a time is where we need to get with this plant, from to increase that quality to all of those components. Then from personal preference, social use. Like, how do we not have social use? This is absurd. Really proud of California and how they are now leading the way again when it comes to consumption clubs and things of that nature. And then, of course, for the overall world, the nonsense of people keeping people in prison for having, you know, honestly had bad luck comparatively, or as the statistics show, had the wrong color of skin. Like, I'm a felon, and I've been a felon for a long, long time, and I did it very publicly, and they just chose not to put me in prison. Like, I've sat down with our now mayor, former U.S. Attorney Jeanne Colwells, with another former U.S. Attorney, John McKay, and they joked about not putting me in prison, which I thought was funny, because I was going to joke about it. But they didn't put me in prison because of whatever reasons they chose. But during that time, they put so many other people in prison. And I get to sit here on a panel and talk about how I run this big business and you know, make money and all these things, while other people are still in prison for doing the exact same things that I did at the exact same times I did it. So we got to pull that curtain back pretty aggressively. And it is just the waving of a wand from a policy perspective.
Yeah. Fantastic. Gianna.
I agree with Danny and Alex about freeing the prisoners, of course. I also agree with the home grow. I really think that people should be empowered enough to grow their own. They shouldn't have to go and buy it from someone if they don't want.
Well, that's basically how all of us started, you know? Right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
One closet, yeah. One light.
I mean, my grandmother grew it. We grew it together. I've grown it. I mean, it should, awesome. Honestly, like, people should have the right to grow their own. You grow your own tomatoes. I mean, why not a cannabis plant, you know, for personal use? From a business perspective, I would love to see mandatory pesticide testing for both growers and processors. And yeah. I would also actually like a requirement to be made. And I don't know if this is going to be favorable, but it's favorable for everyone else. But I think that if growers want to sell you their material for processing, then I think it should be required that they have a pesticide test present. Because we want to make sure that whatever they're growing is not going to be concentrated and be harmful and not be able to be sold. So, you know, I just want to buy clean material. I mean, I grow it. I mean, we grow it in our facility. We grow CBD-rich strains. But, you know, we need more material. And so we have to outsource it. And trust me, it has been painful buying material from growers that fail, okay? Yeah. And not be able to sell it and eat the money. But you know what? I'd rather eat the cost and be safe and keep everyone else safe and not put out harmful products. So I'll eat the cost, and it'll be very hard because we're trying to survive. But you got to do the right thing. And so it would be nice if farmers would work with us and try to help mitigate problems and issues and just work together as a team, you know?
Thank you, G. Nice. Nick Mosley.
Well, these are trustworthy brands up here. I'm going to take an example from these other three and give maybe four things I'd like to see. Ooh. And I'm going to categorize them. I'm just parroting what these folks said. So, okay, so personal preference, social use, right? Social equity, we need expungement of records. This is ridiculous. Patient access, home grow. These things have all been said. Now I'm going to say from a business perspective and coming from the laboratory's perspective.
More labs.
What's that?
No more labs.
No more labs.
Oh, okay.
No, well, but kind of. We'd like to see the regulators take more of a top-down instead of a bottom-up approach to their testing requirements. The consumers are concerned with the products that they purchase, not the plants that are growing in the ground. Right, so the Liquor and Cannabis Board has this 5-pound requirement for all flower. That's an excessive burden for testing on the farmer. When at the end of the day, the consumer is purchasing maybe a cartridge, right? Not the live flower. So I'd like to see a shift in testing requirements away from the farm level and towards the retail level, so that there can be a top-down pressure. For testing, where the businesses can design their own testing regimens without it having to be forced on them by the state.
So, I mean, that's interesting. I do want to point out statistically, like, he's not saying, you know, less testing. He's pointing out a different kind of point of entry on it.
Well, that'd be more testing, right?
I would say less required testing. Oh. I would like to see less required testing and let you businesses decide what regimens you need to facilitate.
See, I thought you were
going to
say random sampling.
Yeah.
But.
I mean, we could go at length about the testing rules and how they could be improved. But
Yes.
That's one.
Yeah, but people grow. I'm a little confused. So you're saying that only the retailer would test it and not the producer processor? Is that what you just said?
Well, I'm going to try to avoid getting too into the weeds about it, but kind of.
One simple magic wand.
As
a producer processor, I would choose what I'd want to test and market with, and then there would be randomized or at retail selection of products.
Yeah, so I think that's a decent description. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say we can describe all the nitty gritty of it, but generally more of a shift towards end product and less of an emphasis on burdening the farmer.
Interesting, excellent. All right, Stink Bud.
Interesting.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we'll get to my wish. My wish in just 1 second. We in Oregon, it's pesticide testing is required.
Yeah.
It works good. It's great. You know what's interesting is one time we actually had our we don't use any pesticides. We're our farm was 100% organic and just. And one time we came back positive though, and you can get it retested and stuff. So it's kind of interesting. It was like. They're really anal about it in Oregon about catching people on the farms and stuff. And what happens is just farms don't use those pesticides. There's certain pesticides that you can use that are certified, you know, organic type pesticides, and you can't use anything else. But we also get stuff tested. We're also required to get stuff tested for on the processing side of things. Sometimes what happens is there might be like really super small amounts of pesticides on the farm, but then once it's concentrated, it actually will pop positive. And so, the reality of the situation is, and then also, like, for example, I don't want to go buy 2,000 pounds or 3,000 pounds of product or more and then get it back and process it all and then find out that it didn't pass pesticides. So the farm will always pay the $75 because, you know, on a commercial level, it just makes sense to get it tested before you go and process, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds. As far as testing goes, I support the testing. I think I believe in terpene testing. We had all of our every strain tested for terpenes, and that's not required. That's not part of the law. But if I were to have my wish, if I could change one thing, I believe that was the question and stuff. I think I would change access for veterans. Like right now, when I go to the VA, they can't prescribe anything cannabis related. They're not even allowed to talk about it. So if I go in there and I have skin cancer, my only option is to get it cut out. Like they can't prescribe Rick Simpson oil or anything like that. If I go in there and I have depression or if I have pain, like for my arthritis and stuff, they can't prescribe. They can give me opioids all day long, but they can't give me anything that's cannabinoid related. I'd love for veterans to be able to have access to, you know, our doctors to be able to at least even talk to them, talk to us about it. I had in my record that I'd worked for a cannabis-related company and stuff, and then I'd gone in for an appointment, and the doctor's like, "So you work for a cannabis company?" I thought he was going to start giving me a bunch of issues, to start asking me a bunch of questions because he's really curious about it. Because these doctors, they don't really know what's going on, you know, and they're a lot of them are curious, and they can't even talk to each other about it. So if one finds out about it, they kind of have to talk about it under the table because it's just federally against the law, and the VA can't do anything about it. There's 22 veterans on average commit suicide every single day. So just think about that for a second. 22 veterans. These are the guys that went out there and fought for all of our freedoms to be able to smoke weed, that sort of thing, are dying every single day from suicide, from post-traumatic stress and other issues as far as trying to get back into society. You know, I know for a fact that cannabis can help depression. I've experienced it myself. I can see. I've seen it with other people and stuff. You know, I'd love to be able to see, us maybe... it'd be great if the 22 too many went out of business. You know, it'd be great to just maybe stop the deaths of suicide. If it can help the veterans, maybe we can help other people. Maybe we can find some strains that's specific for helping people that have depression and stuff. So we can't do any of this stuff. We can't do studies. We can't do research and stuff until it's legal on a federal level. So obviously everybody would like to have it legal on a federal level 100%. That's like a wish. That's not like a personal local wish, but I think everybody here would love to see it so that veterans can could get access, and pretty much everybody can just, you know, stop the prohibition. You know, it's just absolutely crazy. It's ridiculous that you can't even talk about it. So,
thank you, Stinkbud. Anybody have any responses to each other before I go out into the crowd and check for questions?
I think we fixed it.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, just do those things. We're good.
I think that one of the things that's very interesting to me is how the public policy conversation tends to pit, you know, the legal market against the traditional market. That basically, like, the traditional market is the black market and it's bad, and we're just trying to get rid of it. That's why we have the legal market. But when you actually get to talking about, like, well. You know, for example, you know, breeding and the availability of cultivars that come into the new system, like there's a synergy as well. That it's not just sort of a competition where the home growers are a threat. So I actually kind of want to ask the panel, like, how can we push back against this, you know, binary, I guess, that like legal cannabis is here to drive out the black market. What could we possibly say to policymakers or to other folks to try to convince them otherwise? Because without that, home grow is not happening, for example.
Well, for me, I would say you have to allow the people from the underground to work in the industry above ground,
yep.
You know, and make it less overregulated of an industry above ground so that the incentive is to, you know, be legal. And that's, to me, I mean, the biggest impediment is that some of the best growers in America can't work in the legal industry because they have convictions, you know, and they're not allowed to be a part of it. And I think that's really a major impediment to it. And I think the overregulation of the legal industry, you know, puts the incentive on staying underground where there's no regulation at all.
Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, I looked at it a bit differently. For one, you know, the reason that there is the, you know, illicit market against the commercial license market and why they're pitted against each other is the fundamental fact that this all boils down to capitalism. And we all originally thought, like, we'd use this funny little plant to, like, stay outside of capitalism, and we were completely wrong. And so we're traded on the majority of the public exchanges in the world. There's plenty of suits and Wall Street types kicking around, and it's business. So fundamentally, that's why. It's business. It's capitalism. And the real way to, you know, remove this dynamic, truthfully, is to a degree of completely removing the illicit market by freeing all marketplaces. The reason that people illegally grow in Washington is that they can ship it to New York or Iowa, or it's hard to keep track of what states are still not cool. Utah. Utah's not cool. Actually, Utah's getting better-ish. Idaho. There we go. Idaho's got a long way to go.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma's good, dude. Good. Oklahoma's like here 2012, man. It's wild. I was down in OKC a couple months ago. That's there we go. That's the truth of it, is that people, the vast majority of the reasons people are cultivating illicitly is because there's still illicit markets, because we have not freed it completely. Sadly, we are freeing it into capitalism and corporatism, but that is how the world runs. I have come to truly understand as much as I have fought it. So that's what's going to come of it. Yes, there has to be a way for great cultivators to come in. I think a lot of each state learns from the previous state. So, like, for instance, California, it's going to be pretty hard for you to be barred from owning a license if you just got in trouble for cultivating. Whereas, like, in Washington State, well, if you have a cultivation conviction, it had to be a certain window of time. So we're getting better from that social equity perspective. Or if you do have felonies, well, be corporate. Have a hidden ownership. World's about paperwork and confidence, I've learned. So however you got to get in. But the having an illicit market and growing in, you know, running 24 lights in a garage, like, I'm sorry, that's just going away. So either you just grow for yourself and a couple friends for fun or for medical purposes, or you scale up and you're a licensed operator. That's the only two ways I see it folding out once all marketplaces are truly free. So, and to be honest, and I just a little pushback from your response, Danny, of less regulation, and I think that's insinuating more licenses and going away from the big marijuana mentality like New York did or Illinois did. We've learned here in Washington as well in Oregon, that's super dangerous for people because it's a great way to lose your life savings. I mean, we started at something like 2,000 licensed producer processors in Washington State. Last count I heard, we're down to about 600.
Right.
So let's say it's $100,000 per license that was lost, which it was way more than that.
It was a lot more.
That's millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars that's gone. It went into lawyers' pockets and HVAC providers' pockets for sure, and it stimulated the economy. But it is a bit dangerous to just have an a completely open-ended license and regulated scheme just simply for people's livelihoods.
All right, I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
Let's go.
Because those people lost money not just simply because of a supply and demand thing. They lost money because the whole system was governed very poorly and gave nobody a chance to actually make money fairly. So an open market that actually allowed people to fairly to locate in places that made sense, to be able to actually have more retail locations open across the state, that would have helped suppliers.
But there's
a lot of ways in which the open-ended thing, like failing a bunch of people, doesn't work out when you actually look at it. It wasn't about the market, it was about the bureaucracy.
To a degree, but so long as you have marketplaces that are unavailable to an operator, you can always make that statement. If Idaho's not online, well, we didn't have Idaho. There wasn't enough export opportunity for us.
I mean, but that's apples to oranges. You're talking interstate commerce. I'm talking about intrastate commerce, which was the system that we were making.
We did not need 2,000 tier threes to
supply consumers. We needed 300 retail spots, basically?
No, I don't disagree with that. More
because they go both ways.
More retailers for sure, but I wrote the paper for the state on the supply scale. We just didn't need that much cultivation. We just truly didn't. When you do the yields per square foot, you take the amount of consumers, the average amount of consumption, you do the math on the overall consumption expectation for consumers in the state, then you take tourism and you add on top of it, and they said we were going to have a $2 billion marketplace of consumption. I don't remember the math off the top of my head, but that's X numbers of grams of cannabis. You can yield Y number of grams per square foot annually. So you run that math out, then basically all the cultivation necessary in a highly efficient manner could be done in something of the order of 150,000 square feet of canopy. We licensed way more than that, to the point where source material got down to 20 cents a gram. Indoor cannabis was wholesale trading at $1. Yeah. Yes, if we had more retail outlets in banned areas, for sure. But you can count the number of unserved marketplaces on one hand. It's not 100 unserved marketplaces in the state of Washington.
Hill is an unserved marketplace.
Yeah, but the...
I think that like you're thinking about this in a way that is I think, a little bit... Like, you're assuming that Soviet style, we could centrally plan. We know how many consumers there are and how many they want, and then we're just going to make
a
canopy.
No, that's not what I'm suggesting. No, I'm not suggesting
really
just big. I'm suggesting and for a completely open and free marketplace. But we do not have that. And until the federal government acts on that, we will not have that. Say again.
So Oregon would be the example?
Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon is the freest marketplace.
Let's can grow.
Down in Oregon, we're allowed to grow four plants down in Oregon legally. Anybody, you don't have to have a license. You don't have to be registered with the government. Anybody that has property, it's four plants per property, but anybody you don't have to be registered or go and get a license or any of that kind of stuff. And what that does is what I've seen personally is that you do see a lot of weed, but there's so much weed out there you can't even sell it. It doesn't even worth it. Like you just give it. There's just, everybody has weed. You know, bumps. Oh, really?
It's great to give it away. I gave away a lot of cannabis today. That's my favorite thing in the world to do. But to pull you back to why I made the statement of not a completely open and free marketplace is so people didn't lose their retirement. I watched people lose their retirements. I watched people mortgage their home because this was going to be the biggest thing since sliced bread, and they lost their home. Like, that was a result of, yes, poor management of regulators, lack of stores, which we've increased the store count. But the simple fact that there were 2,000 operators does not allow for everyone to be successful.
What percentage of those 2,000 operators had ever grown weed before at all?
Can I say something real quick? Down in Oregon, what was happening is a lot of big money was coming into Oregon. They were able to, they know they could lose money for 3 years. They plan on losing money. And so what would happen is all the smaller farmers, the you know, just the mom and pop places and stuff were all getting shut down. When they first started growing, the prices were decent and stuff. But what happened is all the money came in from Colorado and from all these other states, California, these big investors and stuff. And they had huge money. They knew they're going to lose millions and millions of dollars, and they planned on it. And they go in there and they sell the product at such low prices, and they have so much of it that they're able to go out and shut down all the small mom and pop farms, and they go out and buy them all and stuff. And so some of the problem is just the way it's regulated, is that like you can have people come in with lots of money, and they can shut down very easily, like basically all the small craft type cannabis companies. It's really hard for them to survive. And so, you know, it's not just a single answer, you know what I'm saying, that's going to answer the question. Because, you know, if you regulate it and say, okay, we're not going to have as many licenses and stuff, because that's what they had to do in Oregon, because it was so flipping crazy, you know, the prices, I mean, I could tell you the prices and stuff, you wouldn't believe me. It's just unbelievable. People are just literally, like, put my stuff on the store, on the shelf, just so that people will see my name, because, you know, the stores are so overwhelmed with farms and stuff. And so, you know, I can understand that, you know, you can have too many regulations, but what happens is, you know, it goes in the free market can kind of help and stuff, but who's losing out? It's all these small mom and pops that can't compete with these big corporations. So, how do we take care of that? And so I would love to see, I work in the commercial industry, so, but I would love to lose my job, because everybody is growing their own weed and nobody has to buy it. I know it's a stupid dream and everything, but I would love for everybody to supply their own cannabis and be able to give it to their friends and stuff. And I think that would be my biggest goal, is that, yeah, if you can't grow, you have to go out and buy. But again, it's not at these ridiculous prices, and where medical patients can't afford to go out and buy their medicine now, that sort of thing. It's just ridiculous.
Fabulous. I'd like to give Nick and G a chance and closing statements, and then I might get like one question. I'm sorry. I had to push Alex, my friend Alex, a little bit. All right. Nick and G, got anything for us?
Well, basically, all very good arguments. I agree with all the gentlemen up here. But I would just like to say that unless the government's going to give us back our plant, it's just not going to happen. There will always be an illicit market, you know. So people don't want to be regulated. They want the plant. They want to grow it. They want to do what they want. And they want the plant freed. And it's not going to happen, unfortunately, because the government is already in it. And so I say deregulate, but I don't know, it might be too late, but...
Deregulation means no pesticide testing.
Well, but you're growing your own, okay? You're growing your own. They're not going to the store and buying it. They can grow their own.
What about pesticide drift?
Pesticide what?
Drift.
Well, again, if you're growing pot, that's something that you need to know. You're responsible for your own medicine, okay? I mean, if you can grow your own plant, your own medicine, why would you come to me, right? You can do it yourself, and that's okay, you know? You can grow your own, or you can go buy it, you know? You have the control. That's the whole point of this. If you want to buy a pesticide-written product, that's on you. But I prefer to provide you with a clean product. So that's where I stand. It's all about control and making your own decisions, okay? That's what I'm saying.
Nick?
So the question was, what is going to bridge the gap between the legal market and the illicit market, or what has created the rift between the two? I think Alex pointed out it's not purely a legal market. A lot of the illegal activity in this state is happening because folks are growing and then exporting to other states where there are not legal markets, so that's one. I think the market is overregulated. It's overregulated and it's overtaxed, so that's two and three. And then number four, the corporatization of the legal market is leading to a loss of trust among consumers, and that's what drives a lot of them back to their illegal sources. As much as I think that we are overregulated, I would also agree that a pure free market is going to drive massive and rapid consolidation, which is probably not what we want to see either.
Excellent. Thank you. What I'm going to do, because it's actually 12:10 and the end of this, we got 5 minutes to the next panel, is I'm going to ask each of the panelists if you would please go ahead and just pop out over there for just a couple minutes for anybody that wants to ask you a question, so that you're just make yourself available for just a moment, because we did run out of time a little bit, and I do realize that was probably my fault. My name is Dominic, and I am your moderator. Please give a round of applause to our panelists. Thank you.